When Justice William Brennan was asked from time to time, "What does the Constitution mean?" he had a standard response. He would raise his right hand and spread his fingers apart, and when his listener would look at him in puzzlement, he would say, "Five. The Constitution means whatever five members of this court say it means." And though that may sound cynical or even facetious, it's actually quite true. The Supreme Court has enormous power to interpret our United States Constitution, and so it becomes very important how the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution. What sort of rules do they apply to themselves when they interpret it? And among the various schools of thought is one that you've probably heard of. It's called strict constructionism. But what the heck does that mean? I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and we're talking about strict constructionism.
Your weekly constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
Our topic today is a phrase. It's a phrase that you've probably heard bandied about, especially if you were watching CNN or C-SPAN during a judicial confirmation. The term in question is strict constructionism, or sometimes strict constructionist. And you'll typically hear people who are on the political right refer to themselves in this way. They'll say, "I am a strict constructionist when it comes to interpreting the Constitution." But what does that term really mean? Now we're going to talk to a guy, we're going to talk to the expert. We're going to talk to the guy who's actually in the process of writing the book on this subject. His name is Joe Lane. He is a professor of political science at Emory and Henry College in southwestern Virginia. He's actually the chair of the political science department. He also runs the pre-law advising center there at Emory and Henry College. He's very, very knowledgeable. He's written extensively on the American Constitution and constitutional history. And so let's talk to him now for a few minutes. Well, Joe, thanks very much for being with us. It's a pleasure having you on again.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Stuart. Thanks for having me.
All righty. Well, I want to ask you, you're the expert on this strange term called strict constructionism. That's a term we hear bandied about a great deal these days, typically by more conservative commentators and lawyers. What in the world does it mean? What does it mean to be a strict constructionist?
Well, the answer to that question, there is no simple answer to that question. Who the strict constructionists are, if you look at this historically in American political development, changes over time. What we can say is that strict constructionism is apparently always with us. It was there at the beginning of the Republic. It's certainly there today. We have, with very few exceptions, always had people who said that they stood for the strict construction of the Constitution, that was their party platform, that was their judicial philosophy, that was their guiding principle. That's been common. What hasn't been common is exactly what strict constructionism means at any given moment in historical time. It moves around. And that's the story that I've been working on trying to tell in the book that I'm working on now, is how it moves around and what this tells us about the theory of strict construction. In what sense is our Constitution something that could be strictly constructed? And is there, in fact, a single meaning to that term that we could actually anchor the Constitution to? Or is it, by its very nature, something that is historically contingent and mobile?
I know your research is still ongoing, but can you give us a historical arc in general terms, at least, as to what it has meant from the beginning of the Republic up till now?
I think so, at least in terms that this book is constructed on, what our primary turning points as we see it are. We start in our first chapter is working on strict construction in the very first Congress. At this point, strict construction is not really a judicial term. And in fact, we don't see it used in the Supreme Court of the United States in that way until the Chisholm versus Georgia case in 1793. And even then, only sparingly for quite a while. It's mostly a political term. It's used in debates in Congress to debate whether or not a particular act pending before Congress falls within Congress's authority. And so if you look at it in the first Congress, where strict construction starts to come up, it comes up in a variety of sources. It comes up most obviously and probably most famously in the question about whether or not Congress could charter the first bank of the United States. a little bit more well-known but not as well-known, and an argument about whether or not the president could fire appointees who had to be advised to and consented to by the Senate, even though the Constitution says nothing about how such people would be removed other than that they might be impeached, or presumably they might choose to step down, choose to resign, but also in all sorts of little things. Whether or not Congress could authorize funds to be used for building lighthouses or for dredging ports, for instance. Was that strictly construed within the authority given to Congress to regulate interstate commerce and commerce with foreign nations?
Okay, now what, during all these early battles, great and small, what was the position of the early strict constructionists? What were they saying about these issues?
Well, when you first look at it in the first Congress, what you find are the early strict constructionists are mostly obstructionists. They are the anti-federalists.
The strict obstructionists. That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. Okay.
They're the anti-federalists who get elected to that first couple of Congresses who want to make sure this government doesn't do a whole heck of a lot of anything. And it's their whipping boy for saying, no, we can't pass this and no, we can't pass that. And you kind of get the impression that if they thought they could bring it up on every bill that was brought in front of the Congress, they could. But by the bank bill, they start to pick up some more prominent supporters, including James Madison, who invokes strict construction several times in the speeches he gives against the idea that Congress has the authority to charter a bank of the United States.
Now, does it really boil down to them simply saying, I've got a copy of the Constitution in my hand here. I don't see anything there about a bank. Therefore, we can't do a bank.
Yes. It comes down exactly to that the Article 1, Section 8 grant of congressional authority is only the things that are listed verbatim in the grant.
And it's not just the commerce power in Article 1, Section 8. It's pretty much anything Congress proposes to do, you've got to, at least according to this theory of strict constructionism, you've got to be able to point to a place in the Constitution where it unequivocally says you can do whatever it is that Congress is purporting to do at that time.
Yes. It is very narrow. It is a doctrine that denies the existence of any implied power in the federal government. And in fact, Fisher Ames, the famous Federalist thinker, uses this against James Madison when we get to the bank debate, because Fisher Ames pulls out against Madison that very narrow understanding of what strict construction might mean. When Madison invokes strict construction to say we can't charter the bank, Fisher Ames starts bringing up votes Madison's taken earlier in that Congress and saying, well, James, if you want to stick to strict construction, you voted in favor of building these lighthouses. Where in the Constitution did it say we could build a lighthouse? You voted in favor of allowing the president to remove these people from office if the president decided that he wanted to remove these cabinet officers from office. Where in the Constitution does it say that we can do that? You voted in favor of this. So Madison favored a narrow compass of implied powers. He didn't think everything was listed verbatim. And he wanted to invoke strict construction, and Fisher Ames turns it back on him and says, oh, that's not, I think you've misunderstood what the other gentlemen mean by strict construction. They meant if it's not listed verbatim, you can't do it. And it's almost entirely a political argument within Congress at this moment in time. It's not a broader argument about your sympathy with the Constitution so much or anything of that character. It's certainly not a rule of judicial construction, as it later comes to be a rule of judicial construction. It's a political argument about what the powers of Congress are within Congress.
Okay, and by and large, a person who would call himself a strict constructionist at this early point in the Republic is a person who, as you say, is to some extent an obstructionist. He doesn't want the Congress to do certain things. And more generally, is a person who simply sees the federal government as being a smaller, weaker entity than certainly modern-day Americans tend to think of it. And so I'd like to ask you about perhaps the seminal case in this area during this era, mm-hmm. and that, of course, is McCulloch versus Maryland. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's the famous case where not only was the Bank of the United States declared constitutional by John Marshall's court, not only did John Marshall's court say that the state of Maryland couldn't tax the Bank of the United States, but that's where Marshall gave his famous ringing statement, we must never forget that it's a constitution we are expounding. Right. And then he went on to say that, of course, no constitution could contain every grant of power. No constitution could be that detailed. It would be unworkable. It would be too lengthy. So didn't McCulloch versus Maryland end the debate?
Actually, no. I argue that McCulloch versus Maryland begins the debate.
Oh,
or at least begins the debate in a new way.
Right.
Now, strict construction language doesn't actually appear in McCulloch versus Maryland. Strict construction is always sort of around, but it sort of drops down in the 18 teens during the era of good feelings. Everybody's a Jeffersonian Republican. Party division matters much less, and strict constructionism isn't invoked nearly as often if you look during that period. But starting with McCulloch versus Maryland, with this ringing endorsement of a broad approach to looking for implied powers, we launch into this new era. And McCulloch versus Maryland, we have to always remember, is a seminal political event. It draws to the bar for oral arguments some of the leading political figures of the day. Among them, Daniel Webster is one of the counsels in the case. William Wirt, who was then former founder, member of the Constitutional Convention, major political thinker of the day, is also a counsel in that case. You have these people who are really very politically well-connected, and they argue for days in McCulloch versus Maryland before the court, and then Marshall spouts out this broad theory of broad congressional authority for implied powers. Everything breaks out.
I have to interject here. Sure. This is slight digression, but you're painting a picture here, and I want to fill it in. In those days, mm-hmm. oral arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court were spectator sports.
This was a spectator sport.
And they often didn't even file written briefs. It was all done in oral argument, and these things would go on for days.
4 days.
And this is the moment at which I start thinking to myself, wouldn't it have been cool to see Daniel Webster arguing in front of the U.S. Supreme Court?
If they had had blogs, these things were followed so carefully in the newspaper. If they had had blogs and wireless access in the room, they would have had commentators filing updates paragraph by paragraph, moment by moment.
Yes, they would have.
This was the showdown.
Yep.
There were bills to tax the Bank of the United States queued up and ready to go in other states that had branches of the Bank of the United States. The resistance to a broader understanding of federal authority was simmering, and things were set to explode. And when it does come out, the fallout is so terrible that John Marshall actually has to take to the public presses, calling himself friend of the Constitution, to write op-ed pieces defending what the court has done.
That's right.
And disavowing more hyperbolic claims that people are making about what the court has done, that there's going to be, he's essentially authorized an implied power for Congress to abolish slavery in southern states. He's essentially authorized an implied power that's going to allow the federal government to start nullifying state laws that they don't like, taking over state institutions like colleges and universities and things of that nature. It was all over the place. And we can't lose sight of the fact that this also takes place as the single party dominance of the Jeffersonian Democratic Republicans is eroding. Right after McCulloch versus Maryland, we find ourselves in this last term of James Monroe and this nice, neat, orderly sense that, this president, then this president, then this president from this one party are going to take over from one another. People are waking up to the idea, no, there is not going to be an heir apparent. This is going to be a dogfight in 1824.
This is your weekly Constitutional. We're talking with Professor Joe Lane of Emory and Henry College about the strange term strict constructionism. After a short break, we'll come back and we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll talk more to Joe.
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious. If you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
It doesn't mean anything.
It can mean exactly what you want it to. When Stone Age men were chatting, simply grunting would suffice.
Well, it's time again for the Constitutional Quiz, and into the studio strides the quiz guide, Doug Smith. Here he comes, Doug Smith. How you doing, Doug?
Doing great, Stuart. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Do you have a quiz for us today?
Oh, we do. Hey, this is a good one. So the title of the quiz today is,
Guido, not a guy from Jersey.
I get it.
All righty. So today's quiz is about veto. Article 1, Section 7 of the U.S. Constitution lays out a veto process that allows the president to respond to proposed bills from Congress. The president has 10 days to respond. As long as Congress is in session, the president can sign the bill into law, or she or he can say no to the law through a veto. But what happens if Congress leaves town and the president doesn't sign the bill? Is it A, the bill becomes law automatically without the president's signature? B, a pocket veto occurs. Without the president's signature, the bill dies. C, the bill just waits until everybody returns from vacation. Or D, the Supreme Court gets to decide.
Oh, those are some tough choices, Doug. It seems they run the whole gamut. Do we have a contestant on the line?
Oh, yes, you do.
Well, what's your name, contestant?
My name is Rachel, and I'm from Grundy, Virginia.
Rachel from Grundy, Virginia, from my hometown. My goodness gracious. Well, Rachel, did you hear the quiz?
I sure did.
And did you hear all the answer choices?
I sure did.
And do you know which one it is?
Yes, it would be B, the pocket veto.
You're sure of that? You went right to that answer. You're sure it's the pocket veto?
Yes.
You're not tempted by A, the bill becomes law automatically?
No.
You sound very certain. Why are you so certain?
Because I've been reading the Constitution with my government class.
Oh, man, we got a government teacher on the line. Jeez, nice. Louise, we got a ringer on the line.
This is what it takes, though. This is when we invest in teachers, they know what's going on. I think we should send Rachel to Washington.
You think so? Well, first of all, let's just confirm. Did she win?
Of course she won.
Of course she
won. It's a pocket veto.
Tremendous.
That's right, without the president's signature. The bill just dies. In fact, that's a very common thing for a president to do. The president doesn't want to sign it, and the president doesn't want to veto it. Well, what does she, or so far he, do? Well, you just don't do anything. And as long as Congress is out of town, the bill just kind of fades away and dies.
Well, that's tremendous. Congratulations, Rachel.
Thank you.
And you get your weekly constitutional T-shirt.
Oh, that's terrific.
Tremendous. Now, are you going to keep it for yourself, or are you going to give it to your sweetie pie?
Oh, you think he'd wear that? No, I'm going to wear it proudly.
Okay, good. Tremendous. Well, where do you teach, Rachel?
I teach at Mountain Mission School.
At the Mountain Mission
Wonderful.
School, and you teach government, and clearly you teach your students well, because clearly you know all about the Constitution.
Well, I figured if they're going to take a government class, they need to know what our government's based on, and what better way than to read through the Constitution, which is what we've been doing.
Absolutely. And although it seems like you already know a lot, I'm going to encourage you and all other government teachers to come to Montpelier for one of their many teacher seminars on this subject. Doug, you can tell her about that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you can go to learn.montpelier.org or montpelier.org/center. The important thing is go to montpelier.org. And find us. We've got seminars for teachers. And because you're in Virginia, Rachel, I'm pretty sure we could get a scholarship for you to attend one of our seminars. We'd love to do it, in fact.
Oh, that'd be terrific.
Okay. Well, we'll talk more about that later. But in the meantime, congratulations, Rachel, and thanks for playing the constitutional quiz.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Hey, Stuart, it's the Constitution. I, like Rachel, read it for the articles.
All right, let's go back to our conversation with Professor Joe Lane. Now, Joe was telling us just before the break about the pivotal election of 1824 and what was going on in the Supreme Court at that time. It's a fascinating story. So let's go back to Joe.
And then in 1824, Marshall steps right back into it again, this time in Gibbons versus Ogden, authorizing a broad reading of the Commerce Clause. Commerce is intercourse, he says, and Congress can regulate the streams of intercourse wherever they reach, even deep inside the states. So the congressional commerce power now extends to, in Marshall's reasoning, all sorts of intrastate trade that had previously been thought to be off limits of the federal government. Now, in Gibbons versus Ogden, Marshall goes after strict construction. He has a long dicta at the beginning of the opinion, the first sustained discussion of strict construction in judicial language in our history, at least that I found.
And let's keep this very very straightforward and well defined for the audience. John Marshall was perhaps the greatest enemy of strict constructionism in our constitutional history. Is that a fair statement?
I think you could say that's true.
Right.
Yes.
He was the guy. He favored a strong federal government and a broad interpretation of its powers.
Yes.
And he was taking it on explicitly for the first time in that very important case of Gibbons versus Ogden, which involved, of course, navigation rights in New York.
Right. Yes. And New York law was in conflict, or appeared to be in conflict, with congressional law about who authorized shipping into ports. and Marshall finds in favor of the federal government and against New York in the broadest possible terms. He could have decided the case rather more narrowly than he did. But he goes after strict construction. He says, gentlemen at the bar, by which he means the people arguing on behalf of New York, have said we should adhere to a strict construction of the Constitution. If by a strict construction of the Constitution means we read the Constitution's terms freely and fairly and we stay within the terms of the Constitution, I'm all for it. But if what they mean by strict construction is a narrow construction of the Constitution's terms, ones that would weaken the federal government, embarrass its administration, he says, then I have to say that this notion of strict construction can never be admitted. And he goes after people who would claim strict construction as trying to turn the Constitution, in his phrase, into a marvelous edifice, beautiful to look at, unfit for use.
Mm-hmm.
It would so constrict the powers of the federal government to follow strict construction that we simply could not even consider that seriously as a rule for interpretation. And this isn't just a claim about how we ought to interpret the Constitution in a legal setting. You got a presidential election coming up in which one of the candidates is increasingly associating himself with a return to what he called Jeffersonian strict construction. And that's Andrew Jackson. So this is like the Supreme Court of the United States deciding in an opinion that they're going to riff on and on for three or four paragraphs about what's wrong with the campaign slogan of one of the major party nominees for the presidency of the United States.
Wow. Wow.
This is a big political deal. This is well beyond resolving one constitutional controversy. I think that In the understanding I'm working on now, leads into a second phase of arguments about strict construction.
Okay, now let's just make sure we understand where we are then. The strict constructionists have now, pretty much since the inception of the Republic, argued for narrow interpretations, a weak federal government, and it seems that argument has been pretty constant right up through the 1820s, 30s.
I think it stays relatively constant, though muted in the 18-teens, yes.
Okay, and so now we're going to move into a new phase of what strict constructionism means?
Right. Strict constructionism becomes the party doctrine of the party of Andrew Jackson. That's what the Jacksonians stand for. And they're not uncontested in this, but that's their position. So, for instance, their most famous political fight, at least in the early part of the Jackson administration, should the federal government be involved in building roads, canals, other infrastructure? The Jacksonians say, arguing from strict construction, no, that's outside the federal government's authority to be involved in building infrastructure projects. Not in the narrow obstructionist sense that they don't believe in any implied powers of the Constitution, but that they want to keep the federal government within a certain amount of bounds.
Mm-hmm.
And the Whigs are associated, John Quincy Adams and his successors, who are anti-Jacksonians, are argued with a much more liberal construction of the Constitution. But it should also be kept in mind, this is a three-part fight by the 1830s. There's another group who's trying to wrench away the claim that they're the true holders of strict construction, and they're the Southern Ultras. Their version of strict construction is a theory of the Constitution that's less about its particular manifestations, what particular power Congress has. What they mean by strict construction is the recognition that the Constitution is a compact of the states, that the states are parties to the Constitution, and the states don't have to participate in the federal union any farther than they want to or any farther than serves their interest.
Oh, that's interesting. So they're injecting elements of what we would normally call nullification, states' rights, maybe even secessionism into this argument over strict construction.
Right. So you have the group that's anti-Jacksonians, we might say, on the left, Daniel Webster, John Quincy Adams, Henry Clay, people like that, who see themselves as being constitutionalist and unionist. Those are the phrases they use for themselves, but not necessarily strict constructionists. You have a sort of middle group where the majority of the American public seems to be, at least at that moment in time, behind Andrew Jackson. Strict construction is a narrower reading of the Constitution than the Clay, John Quincy Adams group, but not necessarily a constricted view of the federal government's powers. And then you have the Southern Ultras, or who will become the Southern Ultras, who argue that strict construction is a great limitation on the federal government's powers, particularly the power of the federal government to interfere in states' own internal affairs. Internal affairs being defined mostly in terms of slavery.
Interesting. Okay.
And so in the 1830s and 40s, what I'm trying to show is that there's this contest over what is really strict construction. Are the Jacksonians the true strict constructionist? Or are the Southern Ultras the true strict constructionist? And over a period of about 25 years, I think strict construction gets pulled, at least you could, you know, our terms of left and right don't fit very well on that time period, but pulled towards the Ultras. So by the late 1850s, when you start, or even the compromise of 1850, when you hear strict construction invoked in a debate in Congress, you were probably hearing it invoked on behalf of a Southern sympathizer arguing on behalf of the sovereign rights of states.
And see, that's
to
very
keep
interesting.
And hold slaves.
Because up till now, up till you started mentioning the Southern Ultras, strict constructionism and textualism, it seems to me,
they
were
look
pretty much
similar.
Very, very almost synonymous. I mean, you know, if it's not there in the text, then the power doesn't exist in the Constitution. But now you're talking about people who are themselves divorced from the text. They're injecting all these theories of state sovereignty that don't appear anywhere explicitly in the Constitution, and yet they're adopting this banner of strict constructionism.
Right.
Now, that's an interesting phenomenon, because when you divorce strict constructionism from textualism, then it can take on almost any meaning you want it to, can't it?
It does. And in fact, even in modern strict constructionism, you can sort of watch this happen. Strict construction as a theory works best where the constitutional text is most explicit. Now, I'll give an example that I think most people can follow. In Article 1 of the Constitution, if you approach Article 1, which is about Congress as a strict constructionist, what you find is that a strict construction, as mostly understood in American history, means stay within the bounds of the list of powers Congress has given in Article 1, Section 8, because it's fairly explicit. But if you take the strict construction philosophy over to Article 2, the presidency article, where Article 2 is a vaguer article, it has many fewer explicit statements, what happens to strict construction is it actually authorizes tons of things outside the text. They take what little text is available, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States, but they don't have a list of executive powers in Article 2, so they say, well, we have to be strict. What is the executive power? And they go into all sorts of theoretical discussions about what did John Locke think the executive did and what does executive power include for the framers and which framers thought what powers fit into the executive power. And so you get arguments like those of John Yoo that were offered for the George W. Bush administration. A strict construction of the executive power means the president can go to war without having to get authorization from Congress. That once at war, the president can incarcerate people he thinks are enemy combatants where he thinks appropriate and when he thinks necessary and for however long he wants to. All these sorts of things. They say they're being strict with the word executive, but strict construction applied to more theoretical concepts paradoxically carries you out of the text more than into it.
Yeah, it does. It's sort of the Alice in Wonderland. It means whatever we say it means.
And I think that that's what happens to it also in the 1850s. The Ultras start with a theory of what the Constitution is in terms of what type of compact it is among the states.
Mm-hmm.
And then they strictly apply that theoretical lens back onto the text. Lens first, text second. And they discover that the text says things that the text doesn't literally say. They call it strict construction.
That's very interesting. The strict construction is one of those terms that's a very alluring term.
Oh, yeah.
It's very alluring to say, well, I'm a strict constructionist, because that suggests a fidelity to principle.
And who among us doesn't want to be faithful to the Constitution?
Sure. I mean, and to say that I'm a strict constructionist, and then it becomes a very positive thing. But then, of course, unless it's very closely tied to the concept of textualism, it can mean anything the speaker wants it to mean. Okay, well, we've gotten up to the mid-19th century. Does it morph any significantly past that point, or does it morph so much that you can't even get a handle on it?
Well, what it becomes in the late part of the 19th century, early 20th century, and this is a part of the book where I've really done only the most basic work, so I'm going to say this with that caveat. It becomes a new theory of the Constitution becomes the basis for strict construction, which is the Constitution is basically a framework for guaranteeing the well-being of American commerce and business. What the Constitution is interested in protecting is property rights and business relationships. And so the strict constructionists of the early 1900s up until the New Deal Court are really the four angry old men.
Right.
They invoke strict construction a great deal. The federal government can't interfere in contracts between labor and management. The federal government can't possibly get involved in things like setting minimum wage or maximum price supports, anything of that nature. Strict construction would rule this out because what the Constitution strictly construed stood for was a free market.
So we're going to strictly construe the Constitution to import the term laissez-faire into it.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that's just another, it's just another morph. I mean, it's just another way to say that it means whatever we want it to mean.
Right. And actually, it sort of discredits strict construction for a while. The four old men and the failure, you know, before the New Deal really discredits the term. The term disappears, not entirely, it's always in our discourse, but not like it used to be. You know, for quite a while. When it comes back in is really the Richard Nixon campaign in 1968. Richard Nixon associates strict construction with limiting the amount of rights that should be given by judges like the Warren Court, particularly to criminals.
Right. That was the law and order campaign platform.
Exactly. That we're going to get a hold of these judges. We're going to make sure they're not giving criminals any more rights than they deserve. We're going to constrict down how broadly we read these guarantees of criminal process that have been so blown out of proportion, as Nixon would have it, by the Warren Court, and giving criminals rights that they didn't deserve and aren't constitutionally guaranteed. So now it's really an argument not even about what Congress does. It's an argument about what judges do. And even though the particular focus on which type of judicial activity are we strictly construing switches, I think, from the Nixon administration to the Reagan administration, what we see in that kind of Republican ascendancy and use of strict construction is, for the most part, strict construction isn't about Congress at all. Strict construction is about placing limits on what types of things judges decide and how they decide them.
Right.
It's a judicial concept rather than a political one.
And it continued to morph after the 1980s, didn't it?
It has not stopped, no.
It has not stopped. Well, and thank you very much for shining a light on this, but I must say that even after the light is brightly shined on this area, I'm more muddled than I was before. I still don't know what strict constructionism means. I guess we'll just have to wait for your book to come out.
And I would be probably overly optimistic to say my book is going to settle this question.
I see. McCullough versus Maryland didn't settle it, and neither will Professor Joseph Lane. But thank you anyway, Joe, for coming in. We appreciate this conversation, and we look forward to next time.
Thank you, Stuart.
All right. We've been talking to Professor Joe Lane of Emory and Henry College all about the strange term strict constructionism. This is your weekly Constitutional, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Montpelier had several owners in the 19th century. William McFarland, a Richmond banker, sold Montpelier to Colonel Alfred Vernon Scott of Alabama in 1855. Only 2 years later, in 1857, Scott sold the property to Thomas J. Carson, a banker from Baltimore. When the Civil War began, Thomas Carson remained in Baltimore, and Montpelier became the home of his eccentric bachelor brother, Frank Carson. Confederate troops intermittently camped at Montpelier during the war, and it was apparently also a popular touring place for other soldiers and for refugees. The economic hard times of the post-war era saw the value of Montpelier fall from $8,000 in 1857 to $3,500 in 1881, the final year of the Carson ownership. Frank Carson died in February of 1881 at age 62 and was buried in the Madison Family Cemetery. He is the only non-Madison with a marked grave in the cemetery. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
Someone from the audience asked me to ask you how you would define an activist judge. And it led me to think, yeah, the people who are calling activists, judges activists have generally been neocons and right-wingers, and the appointees to the Supreme Court are extremely activist judges, overturning case law left and right. And it seems to me one of the restraints on free speech that is particularly pernicious is the way that the press has been tarnished as liberal. And anything that's left of a right-wing perspective is called liberal, and the press has fallen over itself to prove that it's not, and essentially shrunk the debate from the center to the right. And I wonder if you think I'm correct in this observation.
I think there's a lot to what you say. I think the right-wing talk shows and the people who talk about activist judges have pushed the debate to the right, undoubtedly, and it's quite worrying. I want to say a word about the phrase activist judges. It's actually an utterly meaningless phrase. It's supposed to imply judges who will decide things unanchored to precedent or reason, but just arbitrarily out of their own preferences. And the suggestion is that that's only done by liberal judges. Well, if that's what it means, and I think it actually means only an activist decision is only a decision you don't agree with, in fact. That's what I think it means. But anyway, if you took the definition seriously, what's the most activist decision of all time? Bush against Gore. Nobody can doubt that. You said it earlier, and you're right. It was a decision without any precedent, which the court said you don't have to pay any attention to in any further case. It was completely arbitrary and ridiculous. Put aside that meaningless term, activist, and let's substitute bold or creative judges. We wouldn't have the First Amendment we have today if we didn't have bold and creative judges. You know, the First Amendment lay unenforced on the Constitution for 140 years. And then for 60 years after 1931, it was vigorously, creatively, wonderfully expanded till it covered all sorts of activities, including burning flags and carrying a red flag down the street. That was a crime in California. Many things all over the map that were protected by the First Amendment, thanks to what judges did, creative judges. So we don't want to be too quick to object to creative judges. One of the great decisions was made in this state by a wonderful judge, Roger Traynor. It's long ago, people don't remember it, but it was at a time when the idea of people of different races marrying each other or having sex together was so sensitive that the justices of the Supreme Court did a dance, literally, to avoid deciding that whether they could constitutionally be prevented from marrying people of a different race. The Supreme Court ducked the issue of miscegenation for years until Judge Traynor decided that the Constitution did not allow the punishment of people because they were of different races and they married. And, you know, it turned out the sky didn't fall, and the Supreme Court adopted that view, and that was creative judging, and brave judging. And I don't think the word activist has any place in the lingo.
Oh, Scalia. The most entertaining dissent I ever read. Scalia, Scalia, Scalia. Views legislative history with much dread. Scalia, 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 Scalia. I just read an opinion by Scalia. Now the Second Amendment will never be the same for me. Scalia, I just heard an exchange by Scalia, and he believes with purpose in no habeas corpus for detainees. Scalia, his thoughts on Roe are unwavering, but he might be okay with gays marrying. Scalia, equal protection isn't much with Scalia. Strict constructionist in the legal world to the very end. But not really.
That was law student Yasser Latifi of the University of North Carolina, Law Review from 2011. I believe that's Law Review, R-E-V-U-E. And just that last segment there where he said not really, he said that right after he held up a newspaper with a headline about the Citizens United decision. Before that, we heard from New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis, who was talking with actor Peter Coyote in 2008 on Fora TV.
Well, now we're talking some more about strict constructionism, but we're going to do it sort of in a backwards way. We're going to do it by profiling a guy who is the anti-strict constructionist. We're going to profile a fellow you may have heard of who's extraordinarily important in this area of the law. His name was John Marshall. John Marshall, he was not the first Chief Justice of the United States, but he is often called the first great Chief Justice of the United States, even though he was the fourth one to hold that title. Now, without ruining the end of this story, I'll simply say that John Marshall's tenure on the court was not only the longest of any Chief Justice, but it was also the most influential. From beginning to end, John Marshall established and expanded the power not only of the federal courts, but of the federal government. And he had a very specific viewpoint that he was advancing. And he is largely responsible for creating the sort of legal system that we have to this day. And he was not a strict constructionist. Here to tell us all about John Marshall is once again Eugene Belenitsky. Eugene, give us the story.
John Marshall is a very interesting guy. He was born in September of 1755 in a little town called... near a little town called Germantown, Virginia. His parents were fairly well off. His father used to work as a surveyor, and he would assist surveyor of land, and he would assist people in moving in and collecting rents from them. So it's a fairly well-off position that his family had.
Okay, so he's sort of a middle-class guy for his era. Okay.
Yeah, not bad.
Not bad.
Not bad. Like Thomas Jefferson, he was related to William Randolph, one of the famous colonists.
All these Virginians were related to each other.
Really?
Yeah, something's going on with these guys. And the funny thing was, is like many families, they all hated each other too. But that's another story. Okay, so he's born in Virginia. He's right. born into a reasonably well-off family.
Right.
What happens?
Despite that, he was homeschooled, which is, from my understanding, it's a standard of that time.
Yeah, I think so.
But at one point, his family does send him off to an academy at around the age of 14. And that's where he meets James Monroe, the future president of the United States.
Okay.
And so he spends a year there, then he comes back home and continues his education.
Okay, also pretty standard for people who had the money to pay for it. Okay.
Yeah. At one point, his father gets a minister to come and help with the homeschooling, and the minister teaches him Latin, amongst other things.
Right. Okay. Sort of a classical education for at least young men of that era of enough means. Okay.
Right. So after that... he enlists in the Continental Army during the American Revolution.
Right.
Where he becomes friends with George Washington.
Right. I think they knew each other. I don't think they were buds. I mean, you know, George Washington was the commander of the whole Continental Army, and I think that Marshall was a relatively junior officer, but they had enough contact that Marshall was certainly became an admirer of Washington, a lifelong admirer of him. Okay.
And he spends a significant amount of time in the military. He serves all the way up to 1780 and... becomes a captain by that time.
Okay.
So then he comes back home. Oh, and during his service, he actually gets his nickname.
He has a nickname?
He has a nickname.
Okay, what is John Marshall's nickname?
It's Silver Heels.
Silver Heels?
Right.
There must be a story there.
There is. When he was in the Army, he used to run and race a lot of the other officers. That was sort of his pastime, which is interesting for that time that they had that type of pastime.
Sure. Well, I mean, you got to do something to amuse yourself. You don't have a lot of sports equipment, but you can always run somewhere. Okay. So he's running around. But where did the Silver Heels come from?
Well, his mother used to sew his clothing, I guess, and she would attach white heels to his stockings. And so that gave him the nickname Silver Heels because everyone saw that.
Well, he sounds like a regular guy. All right. So John Marshall, the road racing regular guy, finishes up his term of service in the Continental Army, then what's he do?
As soon as he gets out of the military, he studies in law school, or at that time, I guess, he studies under a lawyer.
Yeah, he reads the law, right?
He reads the law, and he is admitted to practice in 1780.
Okay.
Then in 1782, He wins a seat at the Virginia House of Delegates and gets appointed Council of State later that year.
Okay, so he's leading a very rapid rise through the legal and the political realm in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Yeah, and in 1788, he gets selected to represent Virginia in the Constitutional Convention.
Big deal. Okay, so he actually goes to the Constitutional Convention, or are you talking about ratification? Which was it? I don't think he was actually at the convention, was he? Because the convention was over in 1787, so I think what you mean is he was part of the ratifying process.
Okay. I'll go with you on that since you're the professor of law. And
You know. Anyway, go on.
Okay. And so while there, he actually puts up a fight for Article 3, which is, of course, the article in the Constitution that grants the judiciary, establishes the judiciary and grants the powers to the judiciary.
Right. Okay.
If I can recall that correctly.
I think you did recall that correctly. All right.
Yes.
And let's just pause here and explain. You have a constitutional convention where everybody came together in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787. But then, of course, that convention concluded by sending out copies of the Constitution to all the states, and they held their own conventions to ratify them. And so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about those subsequent state-by-state approvals of the Constitution. And there were a couple of really key states that really needed to approve this if it was going to get off the ground, and Virginia was one of them. So that was a big battle that we're talking about and a very important one, and John Marshall figured prominently in it. Okay, so after the ratification convention's over.
Well, it looks like he formed his political opinion about how this country should be run during that convention, because immediately afterward he declares that he's now aligned with the Federalist Party.
And the Federalists were the party of Washington and Hamilton and Adams.
Strong central government.
Right. Okay.
Meanwhile, while all that's going on, his private practice flourishes, and he actually gets to represent a few fairly high-profile cases before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay. So he's a Supreme Court advocate. He's really moving up in the world.
He is.
Okay. And so what happens after that?
And then in 1795, Washington offers him to be the Attorney General of the United States, and he declines.
Wait a minute. George Washington offers him the Attorney Generalship, and he says no?
Yeah, it's quite remarkable.
That is remarkable.
And then in 1796, the next year, Washington wants him to be a minister to France. Well, he declines that one, too.
He says no twice to George Washington.
Yes.
Well, he does not lack for... I think the term is chutzpah. All right, go on.
But in 1797, when President Adams wants him to go to France and represent the United States, he agrees.
So finally he goes.
He relents.
He relents. He goes to France. He represents the U.S.
And that's where he gets involved inadvertently in the XYZ affair.
The XYZ affair, where there were French officials who were supposedly demanding bribes from American officials. And if I recall my history correctly, Marshall refused.
Right.
Okay.
And the American people were outraged by the French, and he became popular.
Marshall became
in the United
popular.
States. Marshall became popular in the United States for rejecting the bribes
and rejecting the entreaties to give the
to
bribes.
Give the bribes.
Okay. Very good. Yeah. Yeah. Marshall was a stand-up guy, and he was so perceived. All right.
Well, in 1798, he again declines a Supreme Court appointment and recommends somebody else.
He's turned down George Washington three times. This is remarkable. Or are we up to four now? Anyway, he's told George Washington no on several occasions.
And then he turns around and runs for the United States House of Representatives.
Okay.
He wins, partially because of his popularity due to the XYZ affair, and partially because Patrick Henry supports him. And as you recall, Patrick Henry opposed them during the ratification
process. Yeah, Patrick
process.
Henry was an anti-federalist.
Right.
Okay, so they were on opposite sides of the ratification debate back in 1788. But several years later, Patrick Henry apparently, no hard feelings, apparently he's a supporter of Marshall's now.
Right.
Well, that's impressive.
Yeah.
Okay, what happened next?
Well, then President Adams nominates him as the Secretary of War, but withdraws the nomination and names him as the Secretary of State.
Okay.
And he accepts that one.
So finally, he's Secretary of State.
Right.
Then what? Well, then what? Is that the top of his career?
Well, no. Well, he eventually, as you've introduced, becomes the Supreme Court Justice of the United States.
Okay.
During the Midnight Judges Act, which is known as the night when they were just appointing judges
Layton John Adams's presidency, right before he left office, he appointed all sorts of federal judges.
Right.
And John Marshall was perhaps his most important, well, undoubtedly his most important appointment. He appointed John Marshall to be a Chief Justice of the United States and left office. And very soon thereafter, John Marshall decided the extraordinarily important case of Marbury versus Madison, which essentially established the basic power of the Supreme Court and the federal courts in general to review and declare unconstitutional as appropriate the acts of other branches of government. Now, that's a big subject, and it's one that we're going to talk about in another program in the not-too-distant future. But we're just going to mention it here because what we really want to talk about is what John Marshall did with that power after he established it in Marbury versus Madison. And what he did was he went out and he said, you know what, this is a very broad-shouldered nation, and we're going to have a broad-shouldered government, and our Constitution is going to be interpreted very broadly.
Right, and that's very interesting because, as you know, Adams first offered the job to John Jay, and he declined, and in his declining the offer, he said that the court is weak and it doesn't have the energy or the weight. And so he declined because nobody wanted to be on the Supreme Court at that time.
So John Jay didn't even want to be on the Supreme
Court.
Right,
and as soon as he leaves or doesn't want to be on the court, Marshall prances in there and announces this huge power that the court now has.
Right, so Marshall takes the bull by the horns. He establishes his power of judicial review. And then he begins in a series of cases, probably most notably McCulloch versus Maryland, to declare that, I think in his famous phrase, we must never forget that it is a constitution we are expounding. And that phrase is one of two phrases that's engraved on his bust in the rotunda of the Supreme Court building. And it's generally interpreted to mean that, this new government of the United States needs a lot of power, and we're going to interpret the Constitution broadly to make sure that it has adequate power to do what it's going to be done. So why are we talking about this guy today? It's because he is the anti-strict constructionist. A strict constructionist, by almost any definition, is somebody who believes in very narrowly construing the power granted by the Constitution to the federal government. And John Marshall is the exact opposite of that. All right, well, there were lots of other important cases that John Marshall decided in his 30-year-plus career, but perhaps the other most relevant case to our discussion today is the case of Gibbons versus Ogden. What was that one about?
Well, Professor Harris, there were two conflicting license laws. New York granted its own licenses for steamship navigation, and the United States granted a different license for steamship navigation, and so those two laws were in conflict.
Right, and the issue there was not merely the extent of the federal power to grant the federal license, but also which of the two licenses would prevail, because they conflicted. And Marshall took this opportunity to once again to reiterate that the federal power, this time specifically the federal commerce power, was very, very broad, was plenary, as he liked to say, and that it included all forms of navigation, that it had any touch commerce in any way. And that if there was a conflict between a federal statute on the one side, a federal law of any type on one side, and a state law of any type on the other side, then it was a very straightforward analysis through the Supremacy Clause to say that the federal law is going to prevail. So another strong exertion and approval of broad federal power in Gibbons versus Ogden.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to my buddy Joe Lane from Emory and Henry University. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.